I'd like to call the December 14th meeting to order, regular of the supplemental meeting, and I'd like to recess the supplemental meeting. And then the first thing I'd like to do is have a moment of silence for those who are not with us anymore. Thank you. First item will be the approval of the minutes from the last meeting. Does anyone have any comments? If not, can we have a motion to approve those minutes?
Move. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, and by that, I meant both the required public meeting and the regular meeting. So, Josh, you're okay with that?
Yes.
Look over to the base host, gives me the signal that's okay. All right, so next we want to move to public comment. Would anyone like to speak and say anything?
I'm on the phone for the first 5-star.
Okay. All right, thank you. So now we're going to move to something. I know you guys already understand all this stuff, so it's very redundant. Everyone is almost an expert in this area. But we're going to have Jeff Williams talk to us about the January 1st, 2023 actuarial valuation.
Before I have Jeff start, I'll do just a little introduction. Jeff, is Caitlin on the phone?
I'm not sure. She was
a little fear.
She had another meeting. She wasn't sure she was going to
make it. Okay. So I think most of you have met Caitlin before, but she might be joining on the phone. You know, Jeff Williams, he is with Siegel, and just as a reminder, Siegel is our retained actuary. We've worked with Siegel since 2016. Their role is different to DPSP than Chiron that you saw last month. And Chiron is the independent actuary that was selected by the PRB to do the funding requirements that are in our statute. So I just wanted to make sure you have those two different roles separated in your mind. As we go through the actuarial evaluation, for some of you that have been here for a few years, this presentation will be just slightly different from the past. So first of all, Jeff's only talking about the regular plan today. We usually spend, a minute and a half on the supplemental, but we'll talk about the supplemental next month. So we'll be moving that one. Also in the past, I've taken some of the information that Siegel has prepared, and they have been kind enough to give me an Excel spreadsheet. I make a bunch of charts and graphs based on that information. I didn't do that this year, and the reason that I didn't do that is you are going to see this 1/1/23 valuation so many times today, also through Chiron's work, and it really, those graphs would be irrelevant based on the funding. So you won't see that today like you have in the past. If you want that information, I can put it together for you, but I haven't done that for today. Also, after Jeff completes his presentation, I've asked him to take a little bit of a deeper dive, really casual, he didn't prepare a presentation, I didn't ask him to do that, on a couple of the concepts that you will see as we go through the funding process, one being the actuarial determined contribution, amortization, kind of normal cost, those things that will be relevant as we go forward and are often very confusing. So once he's done with his prepared presentation, he'll talk a little bit about those things and answer any questions that you have from those concepts from Chiron's meeting. Today is not the day that Jeff will talk to you about does he agree with the Chiron's preliminary report or not. Once we get the final report from Chiron, then we'll give it to Siegel and we'll really be interested in their thoughts on what the board should do relative to that. So with that.
Yeah, I'd like to add one thing. I really think that 2024 will be a year of great consequence for us, and in order to be, prepared, we all need to educate ourselves and educate each other, I think, on these core concepts, because I think we're going to be required by the legislation way back when to come up with a fully funded plan and opine and support something, and in order to do that and to have, every voice be additive, we all need to sort of commit to try to focus, a little bit more. I know myself, I've always felt a little weak in this area, and I've really tried to kind of really focus. So I just, think education before opinion and before decisions, I think, is sort of the waterfall here. So,
Kelly, what do you have the time frame for the updated Carvin report and how we can discuss it with Siegel after that?
I do. They have, according to the contract, they have 90 days from really this week to provide us that updated report. I'm hoping that it's much earlier than that, but I don't really know.
I can't speak for them. I know that they're working on matching our 23, and they've asked us a few questions, and you know they did the 22 work, so I didn't. We provided the data. We provided our liabilities for them to. So they should be fairly close. They match pretty well to the 22 valuations. I would expect them to not to take the full. I'm not saying they won't, but
yeah.
I know they're a good bit along in the process.
As far as
matching the valuation results, not necessarily their other work.
I don't think they'll take the full 90 days either. I don't think they're planning on being done before the January board meeting, though. It'll likely be February, but maybe we'll be surprised.
Only because to explain about consequences, we need a year of consequences. We need more information sooner because it's going to have impact.
Right, and they're aware of that. Also, I should have mentioned, later on the agenda, we are going to give you an update on what's been going on that Chiron process since we last met. Jeff's going to talk about the 1/1/23 valuation as he normally does as our regular retained expert.
Okay. Well, thank you. It's good to be here this morning. I'm going to stick with the summary PowerPoint here unless there's any questions about the full valuation. I don't know if you've had a chance to read that electronically or not, but we can go over any questions we have on the full report. This is the highlights. So, the assets were kind of the driver, and I don't want to jump ahead, but let's see here. The amortization period, and we'll talk about this, Kelly mentioned a little bit later, about what goes into the actuarially determined contribution. The amortization and funded liabilities is the driver for that. Set up a few years ago based on the PRB guidelines, actuarially determined contribution for calculating with evaluation. Now, that's not being contributed on, but the effective period test, 22 years. I'm going to jump down to the bottom real quick, though, but the effective period for the actuarially determined contribution is 22 years, but we're projecting full funding right now in 82 years, 2105, which is up from 68 years, 2090 last year. Now, these projections are assuming everything happens according to the expectations, according to the assumptions. We know that's not going to be the case. Some years will be better, some will be worse. But right now, it's so far out in the future, it's, 10 years will be fully funded in 82 years is just not a meaningful statement. That's what we're projecting. And obviously, we didn't need to say it, but we did. It's not considered a reasonable amortization period, 82 years. But jumping back up to the second bullet, for 2023, the actuarially determined contribution is $251.6 million. This is 54.4% of pay. This is an increase from $228.5 million in the 2022 valuation. The increase, and there's a page we'll go through what caused the increase. This is primarily due to assumption changes, investment loss, and contributions being short of the actuarially determined contribution last year. So $228.5 million was the actual determined contribution. 22 actual contributions were just under $170 million. So about 74% of the actual determined contribution. So that gap, the further each year that gap gets a little bit bigger. And the bigger the gap gets between what's actually contributed and what should be the actual determined contribution, that kind of rolls over into the unfunded and rolls. It's going to keep increasing. The actual determined contribution is going to get larger and larger each year. It's not being made. The 23 contributions, based on the 34.5%, 13 million, we're expecting somewhere around 164 million. Hopefully, it'll come in higher than that, but that's what we're looking at right now. And I already mentioned the unfunded liabilities. not projected to be paid off anytime soon.
So, Jeff, just to sort of summarize this, that in order to pay off the unfunded piece in 22 years, is that the time period?
Well, the actual determined contribution, the effective period is 22 years, yeah.
22? Okay. So the city would need all their assumptions being the same, so the 6.5% return and all those, nothing else changing, that the city would have to contribute $251 million per year, or does that go up every year?
Oh, that goes up every year.
Okay. But it would have to be that amount this year in order for it not to increase, right?
Even if the ADEC was contributed this year, we would project it to increase next year because of our deferred investment losses. So those get smoothed in over a five-year period. So even if you're making your actual determined contribution each year, we would still expect it to go up next year because you've got you took a big hit in 22.
Okay. And then with the path that we're on, nothing changing, all their assumptions staying, and it would take 82 years from now to pay off that liability.
That's assuming the hiring plan, the payroll remains at least, those numbers hit each year, and 34.5. Yeah, assuming all assumptions are met exactly, it would take 82 years.
Okay. Back to the 251, if you didn't blend in those losses over years, but you took them as is, and it were still 251. Would that be the number repeated over 22 years?
No.
Would it still go up?
It would still go up. The amortization is being done on a level percentage of payroll amortization. This is a pay-based plan, so it's which is most common amortization. It's not required. That's what's most commonly used. So your amortization payment for the unfunded bases will go up by the payroll growth assumption each year.
Okay.
So they expect to go up by 2.5% each year.
Okay.
So going with what Nick just said, if there weren't any gains and losses to be smoothed in and you met all your assumptions, instead of looking at a flat dollar amount, you could you say that 54.36% of payroll every year into the future, into 22 years, could get you there?
That is a moving target as well because the payroll changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, if all assumptions
if everything stayed
the same.
Okay, perfect.
Then yes, theoretically that would be the number.
Okay. Well, so just so I understand, when you're talking about everything staying the same, you're talking about going along with this. It says the city's hiring plan, so that means that with the police and fire increasing their hiring on the schedule they have listed. So that this is not taking into account if it stays at around 5,100 total members.
So the hiring plan is a term that was created in 2017 that really doesn't reflect the city's plan to hire, even though it's called the hiring plan. So as far as the actuary is concerned, it doesn't matter how many officers are on board. It matters what the payroll is.
Okay.
So even though they haven't achieved their number of officers, they have given bigger raises. So it's that combination of payroll that they really care about.
Right. Like you said, the percentage.
Yeah.
Okay.
One thing, and I can't recall if it's in here or not, one thing we track each year is the hiring plan payroll versus what the actual payroll has been and what the deficit's been because the cumulatively over the years, this is the first year where the pay cumulatively is greater than the hiring plan payroll because there were some large increases over the past year. So this is the first year there was if I recall, the hiring plan assumes I was not part of the conversation. You know, the hiring plan payroll, they set out a target for each year. The average increase, I believe, was about 3.1% over the period, where the payroll growth assumption is 2.5%, but that's really kind of an inflationary assumption. The actual increases we know will be greater. There's with the rate of return, when we look at the rate of return assumption, we look at inflation, which is typically kind of what we think of as our payroll growth increase, and then the real rate of return. I'm getting off topic a little bit, but the 2.5% is our assumption for payroll growth. about 3.1% is the hiring plan increases up through the end of that period. So if the hiring plan, when we do our projections, this assumes it's like the hiring plan can get hit each year. If that was done away with and we just do our projection on 2.5% increase each year, then in 2105, the plan is not projected 100% funded, it's projected 8% funded. So there's, and that's in 2105, 8%. So there's a, the hitting the payroll targets and their plan is very important for these projections.
So Kelly, let me just ask
just
a quick question. So this hiring plan is really payroll number.
Yes.
Exactly.
And that payroll number is tethered to the increase. So like when fire and police get their increase, again, it's with this formula on these other municipalities and that. So that increase and that increase, so the increase for their wages based on that and this.
It's really, yeah, it's everything that they get paid that goes in that's pensionable. So it's their base salary, education pay, and longevity. So whatever the total of that is for everybody on staff, whether it's they're making that because they got a merit increase or step increase or they got promoted or they're brand new or they're at the end of their career, you add all that together, and that's what the city's paying on and the members are paying on as well.
So and that 2.5 is kind of what?
So the 2.5 came about because Siegel had done an experience study. They've done two of them for us, but the 2.5% was what was supported in the last experience study, and that was before some of these big raises. If the city can continue to keep where they are now for the next 30 years, maybe in the next experience study they would consider adjusting that. I don't know if the city can keep up the pace that they have for the last, you know, the last couple of years for the next 30 years or not.
Good point.
Just a matter of, if the city were to increase its ADC, and or we were fortunate enough to get some kind of a significant contribution, have the numbers been generated as to what the benefit to the trust would be, given what ifs? And, yeah, I would think those numbers were pretty compelling.
Yeah, I mean, we can certainly, that's easy enough to do if you give us, hey, we're going to put in this dollar amount at this date. How will that impact projections? That's something we can easily do, but we need to be given guidance on that.
And that's what Chiron's working on.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's a lump sum you projected fully funded in X year. That's not hard to do. It's just we need to assess on that.
And what is the return assumption? I'm sorry if I missed it. What is the return assumption that underlies this?
6.5%.
Thanks.
And just as a side note, in the valuation report, if you're interested in what the numbers are in the hiring plan payroll, it's on page 48. We have it included in our assumption section, and those are only used for the fund projections.
What's a reasonable amortization period?
Well, it depends who you ask. But really, we no more than 30 years. Some folks will say 20, 25. Considering the shape the plan is in, I think there's a plan put in place. Okay, we're going to start paying the ADEC, reset it to 30 years, and start counting down. You can either, there's different ways to do that. We can discuss that a little bit later as far as Kelly's talking about kind of an actuarial 101 as far as the ADC, but there's different ways to do the amortization period as far as level percent of pay or level dollar or if you layered bases or just step down with one day. We'll get into that, but
okay.
We'd like to see it at 30 or less. So the funded ratios, no surprise, drop down in 2022. Probably should have reordered this, but you can see in the middle, the market return was negative 11.46%. The actuarial return was 2.22%. The 11.46% negative, that's in line with what I've seen with my other calendar year plans. I have plans to run with different plan years, but the calendar year plans I work on, primarily between the negative 11 and negative 15% in 2022, which doesn't, you know, I'm not saying it's good that you're negative 11.46, but it's not out of line with what I'm seeing with other plans. So the funding ratios dropped. top of the page. Actuarial basis, it dropped 41.06% to 39.12. Market basis, 41.83 to 34.42. It didn't drop as much on the actuarial basis because you had deferred gains last year. It was smoothing gains and losses over a five-year period. In the 22 valuation, you had $40 million in unrecognized asset gains. This valuation, after the loss in 2022, you have $246 million in unrecognized asset losses. So it flipped and then some. The actuarial value dropped from 2.12 to 2.05 billion, and the market value from 2.16 to 1.81 billion. And then the cash outflow increased just a little bit, about $3.5 million, excuse me. We did make a couple assumption changes, which we've previously discussed. The assumed rate retirement rate for drop actives was lowered from 100% to 75% after 10 years. We previously looked at that, and not everyone's leaving. I mean, some folks are staying. A good bit of folks are staying after they hit their 10 years and drop. You know, they just don't want to go home for whatever reason. They need to work, want to work, whatever. They're not all going home. And then we did update the salary scale assumption based on the 2023 meet and confer agreement. So when we get those agreements, we update the assumptions on that.
Is the actuarial assumption of 6.5%? This seems to be a moving target as well by industry. Is that pretty much standard still, or are you seeing firms move to 6 or 5.5?
For public sector plan, 6.5 is ahead of the curve. I don't have the most recent NASRA survey with me. NASRA is the National Association of State Retirement Administrators. They do a good survey every year. They survey the largest plans in the country.
6.5 is also for rating agencies. They use 6.5.
Okay. NASRA, the latest study, I believe the median and the average was just under 7, and I think the average was 7, the median was 6.9. Something, it was right around in there. So as far as public plans, you are ahead of the curve a little bit with 6.5%. Hit the wrong button, sorry. Okay, so how do we get from 228.5 to 251.6 million? Expected payroll growth increased by 5.1 million. The actual contributions being left from the ADEC increased to 4.5 million. An investment loss increased the contribution to 6.4 million. And then you had some smaller demographic experience gains, which actually brought it down 3.7 million. So prior to the assumption changes, it would have been a $240.8 million contribution, and then additional $10.8 million due to the assumption changes. And we don't like making changes and increase the cost, but we try to be realistic as possible. It doesn't do any good or undervalue the liabilities. You've got big payments ahead of you, and want to be as realistic as possible. So we have a side by side of the key components of the evaluation results. You can see about the fifth row down, total normal cost as a percentage of pay. That increased almost one basis point due to assumption changes primarily. It would have been a little bit higher than 17.09%. That number doesn't change a lot unless there are assumption or plan changes. Just the underlying demographic experience from year to year, it may tweak it a little bit here and there. It might go up and down, 0.1, 0.2, but that's a decent size increase for 1 year. But it's explainable. It's primarily due to assumption changes. Then, of course, the members are paying 13.5%, and you've got administrative expenses in there. So the employer normal cost, the city's normal cost as a percentage of pay, just over 6%. That's not bad. I've got plans where that is, 20-30% range. This is a normal cost. So it's all relative, I guess, but the 6% is not what's driving the cost. It's the unfunded liability. I've said it before, if the unfunded magically went away, the city's finance folks would do cartwheels paying 6% a day.
So, Jeff, does that mean that when the city's putting in their 34.5% every pay period plus the $13 million every year, all that money, only 6% of that 34.5% is going for current employees, and everything else is going to pay off the unfunded?
Yes.
Say that again. Ask
that again. Want to explain it better?
So, like I said, if the unfunded liability magically disappeared, then your cost of the plan would be that employer normal cost, that 6% or $28 million, and that would change a little bit year to year. But the 34, if the city was paying 34.5% and the cost was 6%, funding would skyrocket. I mean, it would be astronomically great. But, you know, you're 39% funded right now. The funded liability is $3.2 billion. So the 34.5% they're paying, only like 6.04%, like in this valuation, would go toward really the benefits. It's paying down the unfunded liability is the key. The benefits, and this is an opinion, but the benefits are not expensive. I mean, they're, you know, the good benefits are, I think, good, but I'm just saying, you know, I've got other fire police plans that normal cost. As percent of pay is much greater. A 6%, a single digit employer normal cost, in my opinion, is great. But
it's great for who?
Well, it's great for the city if they didn't have the unfunded liability. I mean, I'm just saying it's not.
The benefits aren't that great for.
Well, I'm just saying that.
No, I know. It's
the
not,
cost of the benefits to the city, in my opinion, are not that high. It's the unfunded liability and how we got from A to B, that's what's, you know, that's just the $3.2 billion in funded, which is what they're paying for. I guess I shouldn't offer opinions on
that.
But I'm just saying
that
the cost is, in my opinion, 6% is low.
What's concerning to me is that within 1 year, if you look at the bottom, we've added 15 years to full funding in 1 year. And we're at the levels we are, if we have another situation, that could be disastrous at this level.
You can't have too many negative 11 years. I mean, I guess it goes without saying, but, you know, it wasn't that long ago where the plan was projected insolvent, if you remember, back when we were doing all of the plan change work. I mean, the plan was literally projected to run out of money. But that's not the case any longer. Hopefully that will never be the case. But having said that, the unfunded liability is projected to increase as a dollar amount for the next 50-plus years. That's assuming, you know, projections like everything happens as expected or as assumed. Because 34.5% of pay is made, you know, no asset gains and losses, everything hits the target exactly, we would expect the unfunded liability as a dollar amount to go up for the next 50-plus years. Now, that doesn't mean the funded percentage is going down for the next 50 years, but it means that the dollar amount in funded liability is increasing. We still project the funded percentage to go down for, I don't think I have it in here, for the next 15 to 20 years. And we've been saying that all along. It's going to get worse before it gets better, the funded percentage. That was even before the negative 11.46%.
Right.
Even if you'd hit your target, it still would have gone down.
Hey, Jeff, what's the definition of normal cost again?
I guess the simplest way to say it is it's essentially the cost of the benefits accruing each year.
Okay, so it's not what was paid. It's what basically
the
act of being employed creates a corresponding. So it's
the cost. If different funding methods, I don't want to get in the weeds, but different funding methods treat it differently. The simplest way to put it, it's essentially right, is that the 18.08%, if you paid that every year, that would cover the cost of the benefits from hire to, you know, retirement, termination,
okay.
Whatever.
What's a computation pay, the definition of that?
I don't like that phrasing we use, but we started using it at some point. It's the payroll. I mean, we get the payroll, what happened in 2022,
it's the total payroll.
It's
okay.
The three components that I just mentioned.
Okay.
It's the salaries, it's
okay.
education, and longevity. There's other components of pay that we don't get pension on. There's assignment pay and different things like that.
So we're taking the pay and we're adding the appropriate salary scale depending on the person, what their job is and their service, like based on the meet and confer agreement and our assumptions. So we're taking the pay that happened in 2022, we're applying the expected increase in 2023, and that's what we're using as our computation pay. Some plans do it differently, like some would just use the pay in 2022 and then we project forward with interest. We haven't been doing that. Basically, we're saying the pay in 2023 will increase in the year, and that's what the percentage, the 8 percentage is based on. So, it is what it is. ADAC went from 228.5 to 251.6. That fund percentage went out 15 years.
And how much does the return assumption matter, like, just for sensitivity purposes, if that return assumption was 8, like how much does it truncate that time to fund?
I'm sorry, what was the last part of the question, please?
Yeah, just in terms of the 82 years, if you were to assume like 8% return instead of 6.5, like how much does it truncate time? Like how sensitive is it to that?
Well, if we assumed 8, it would be someone else making the assumption. It would, the discount rate is directly tied to the liability and the normal cost. So if you had an 8% assumption instead of 6.5, your liability would be less and your normal cost would be less. Your ADEC would be less. As far as the years to full funding, that should decrease, but the ADEC would also be less, so we'd have to run that. But it does have a direct impact.
Okay, yeah, but so you're just not sure, though, the answer in terms of, like, how much time that helps.
No, I don't have I haven't done anything with 8% on this plan.
Okay, thank you.
Quickly, this is just demographic information. I'm not going to go into the details here.
The one thing
that the pay, average pay went up 6%.
The one thing that I wanted to point out here is, you know, with all the efforts that the city's made in the last, in 2022, they actually lost 3 employees. We had 5,088 actives in 2021 to 5,085.
Sorry, I was looking at the page. So average pay did go up 6%. That's it's a pretty good average increase in 1 year. Of course, the numbers in the dropper will continue to decline over time. The number of actives in the drop, rather. So over the past 15 years, it's you've hit. And there's certainly reasons for this. We know, obviously, there was a write-down of about $500 million. An extra $650 million left the plan in 2017 that we weren't expecting. Things have worked against you. You've been unwinding from some of the assets you've had in place, so you haven't been able to capture some of the gains over the past decade when they've occurred. You can see there's been 4 years of the last 15 that you've hit your market target. You hit the target on a market basis, and 2 years of the last 15, you've hit the target on an actuarial basis, and that's what we look at for the funded percentage, really, and the actual determined contribution. And it's been since 2012 since you hit your target on an actuarial basis, so it's been, there've been some write-downs, there've been some issues that I know you guys are unwinding from, but it's just hurt you. And this is how it's hurt you. Starting back in 2014, if you'd hit your target each year, I'm not talking about taking any big gains that have occurred, just if you've hit your fund percentage assumption your investment return assumption each year, and we'd project the liabilities would be around $4 billion now. instead of $1.8 billion. So hitting the target matters. I mean, if this plan was at $4 billion, then you'd be, what, 70-something percent funded, close to 39%. So that's kind of a sobering chart, but I think it's worth showing. Yeah, and you can see, you know, where you were. Keeping in mind, though, those 2013, 2014 percentages were based on an 8.5% return assumption. And even at that time, that was an aggressive return assumption. So that 7.5 or 8.5 stayed in place. 15 valuation dropped to 7.25, and we took over at 16, and it's come down a couple times since then. Whoops. So a couple times 7.25 to 7.6.5 is where we stand now. Those are the at risk section. Of course, there's really, I guess, the biggest risk are just the money not coming in, not hitting the payroll assumption. There's lots of risk, but we need the payroll numbers to work out as far as that 34.5%, because if that ends up being the contribution long term, then what the payroll is matters greatly. Even if you're hitting that, we've already seen it's, you know, projected 21.5 before funding. So that's one of your biggest biggest risks right now.
Can I go ahead? I have a question for you, and I know this might be a basic question, but is the PRB 30-year a finite cutoff, or is it rolling?
Well, every year. Well, so it's a 30-year close period. So if you are over 30 years to fund in 2025, by 2025, you have to have a plan that gets you closed in 30 years. So by that date, and we will have that because we have to, according to statute, we have to be 30 years to fund on that day. And then the next year, it'll be 29 years, 28,
27. But so it is a finite time.
Yeah,
so they are staying close. So, like, it's not a drag. So you have a plan.
You're not adding a year.
And then a year, the actuarial, and then
you never be funded.
Then, exactly. Okay.
Can you go back to this one slide? I wanted to just mention something. So on these historical results, for those of you that weren't here, in the 13, 14, 15-year time frame, what was actually really highlighted in the valuations from the former actuary was the actuarial value of assets. And during that time, that light blue line, those assets we later found were, a lot of them were undervalued significantly, which is why you're kind of seeing that line go down. Where the actual value of assets is meeting the market value of assets, and that those two converge in 2015. And what's happening in 2015 is we made the decision with Siegel. Was it with Siegel or with Buck when we put?
We started in 2016.
Okay, so for the 15 valuation, normally when you have a smoothing period where you're taking a percentage of your gains and losses every year, that's to react to normal market volatility. Well, our losses at that time were not due to normal market volatility. That was because of they were overvalued, and we needed to write them down. So what we decided to do in 15 was just basically take all the actuarial losses in that year and bring the actuarial value and the market together, because it really didn't reflect normal market movement. So that's why those two lines kind of come together. And since that time period, we haven't had really, you know, according to the line, significant differences between the actuarial value and the market value until really this year, where you can see they're kind of diverging a little bit, and that's because you've got the 11% loss in there that we're only seeing 20% of that hit the actuarial number, but the full amount's in the market value. So I tend to like to always personally focus on the market value of assets.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what's going on there, in case you wondered why this looks the way it does, because it is strange that those two lines come together like that.
I'm going to fast forward through a couple of these. We talked a little about the importance of the projection. Remember I said, I didn't know if this was in here or not. I couldn't remember, but I should know. This is what I was talking about. This is the first. Okay, so yeah, there are differences each year, but this is the first year of the cumulative difference, the cumulative projected pay, city's hiring plan, excuse me, is greater than the projected valuation payroll. But you know, the total under the findings on the right, the total city and member contributions between 25 and 37 based on the city's hiring plan projection is $3.61 billion. If you instead just use the valuation projections of 2.5%, assume payroll growth, it drops down to $3.5 to $3 billion. So the difference is $77 million, which is down from $191 million last year, but still there's a gap. So you want those hiring plan, and this is the hiring plan I mentioned, that's on page 48, those numbers. We need to hit those numbers. We really do. They are important. Other than that, 5% projection, and then just GASB, which I'm not going to go through, but once you get questions on it.
Jeff, we'd like to cheer you up a little bit before we end this.
I know I'm always doom and gloom, but it is what it is. I can't.
No, we want to cheer you up. We're gonna get this right. It's gonna be a big year next year. You're an important member. You're gonna come in at some point. We're gonna get this right. I look at the returns. I mean, the data is what it is. So you can't sit there and say like that's not it. There's just a significant hangover effect of decisions on investments into illiquid asset classes that really occurred over two decades. And, you know, you look back, and we may get to that chart later, where I look at the return on private investments over, you know, 10, 15, 20 years, and it's nothing. So it's carrying that burden, that extra water, that extra weight. We feel really good about where the controllable investment portfolio is and what we're doing. But we have a structural issue where the liability is outsized now, and we need to find a way to address it, minimize it. We get it, and we're on board with that.
Yeah, I mean, it took a long time to get here. It's going to take a while to get back out where you want to be.
Yeah, but we're committed to cheering you up.
I know it's like a black cloud falls when I come in here, but I'm trying to. I can't make the numbers any better than what they are. So.
And we don't want you. We want clarity from you.
Yeah. Like I said before, it doesn't do any good if we're not straight with you and tell you, you know, what we're. There's no way to. Make them better than they are. I mean, it's just.
But the main thing is that you provide clarity and expert opinion.
I try. If I'm not, please let me know.
We appreciate that. Does anyone have any other questions?
So one of the things I wanted to do, we've had a good discussion, I think, much deeper than often we do about some of these concepts. But I've asked John to pull up the Chiron presentation from last month.
Oh, that's a good idea.
And then if you can just go to, I don't know, whatever page Jeff wants, 34, 35, or whatever. Just, I wanted Jeff to talk just a little bit more about, and we had more conversation than I expected, so maybe we don't need to do this. Can you go to, what page do you want, Jeff? Do you want
35?
Let's start on 35, maybe, and then.
How did I have 35?
Can you go back to 34 for just a second?
Yeah. So the reason I want to do this is a hard concept. So if you're not understanding it, I've been doing this for many, many years, and I can't explain a lot of this. So, you know, it's okay to not understand this. But these issues are going to be important when we come to you in the future, the near future, and say, are you okay with this recommendation from Chiron? Because this is kind of what's behind the numbers. And there's lots of different ways to do it, and kind of complicated. So this is one way that Chiron did it in their recommendation. Jeff, what do you want to
I guess the important thing is there's different ways. There's no one right way to amortize unfunded liability, and that's the most important thing is how to pay down the unfunded liability, the total normal cost. So I guess the three components of the actuarially determined contribution are the employer normal cost, really two components, right, and the amortization of the unfunded liability. So we start with the total normal cost, which we said was a little over 18% in this valuation. There's an administrative expense assumption we add on because our expenses paid from the fund. And then we subtract out the expected employee contributions because the members are paying 13.5%. And that brought us down to an employer normal cost of, I want to say it was 6.08%. So that's one part of the actual determined contribution. And then you've got, of course, the actual value of assets, and you've got the accrued liability, difference being the unfunded liability. And that's really where we're at is how do we pay down the unfunded liability. So right now we have amortization bases we're setting up each year, but they're in there because they need to be in there. You know, PRB wanted to see an actuarially determined contribution in the plan, so we calculate that. We have amortization bases. The initial base was, I believe, 25 years, and then we're setting up a new base each year based on the gains or losses or assumption changes that occur in that year. And those are, I believe, 20-year bases we're setting up. And that's perfectly fine. That's great. But it's almost irrelevant because we know the ADEC is not getting paid. You know, the 34.5% is getting paid. If there's a commitment or a statute or whatever where the ADEC has to be paid, then this becomes much more important. It's how are you going to pay down the unfunded liability? And Chiron put something together here, and you know, I know Jake. He used to work at Siegel in our Chicago office, and you know, Bill's a good guy. I like both the guys, and I think they've done good work. I think the amortization payment structure is a little more than I would have done, which is not doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just I was talking to Kelly earlier. I try to keep things as simple as possible to get the job done. I mean, we have a goal here we want to achieve. I think simplicity is best, and this is not hard. It's just a lot of moving pieces. So they wanted to start off with two layers to kind of explain what they did here. And I had to seek clarity from Jake. I was emailing him yesterday, Chiron. I said, well, could you explain this to me? Because I got a little lost myself. So they have a 30-year base they set up, which kind of approximates the expected stream of 34.5% contributions. At least that's my understanding. He said they set up a base of $2.5 billion, payable over a 30-year period, level percentage of pay amortization. And then the difference between the expected and funded in 2025 and that $2.5 billion, that's when they started grading that in. They had so they graded that in. They said over they had a 29-year base, and 29-year base, and then each year they're adding. They want to step it up over a 5-year period and start stepping it down. Where they, you know, I don't want to go too deep into it. It confused me, but I could do the math on it once I have a better feel, but it just. I think there was some moving pieces, but
so kind of a high level summary.
Yeah,
is so we've got an unfunded liability of 3.4 billion, right?
Right.
And we have to pay that off in 30 years. The city is going to probably want to push those payments off as long as they can, pay as little upfront as they can, you know, for budget reasons. It's practical,
right.
And have a lot of it come in the back end. Well, just if you did that with your, you know, formal mortgage, it's going to cost you more in interest. You know, it provides more risk.
Yes.
For the plan's purposes, for our funding level and I think for our security, I would prefer to have more money up front. So I think that's where the big part of the conversation is going to be.
Right.
There's a chart on the next page, which is really pretty and all of this stuff. But all of that to say is what's going to underlay what the city's ADC is, if they go to the ADC, the actual determined contribution, is really how you're taking that big chunk of money and paying it off in 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
You can do it kind of like they did, where you take the UAL and it's a flat dollar amount for a period of time, and then as you have new gains and losses each year, they do this. You can make it complicated. You can make it simple. But at the end of the day, it's when is the money coming in, and what advantages does that have to the system or to the city, and what makes the most sense? Does that make sense?
It does. And so there's when we're amortizing the unfunded liability, you can either do it as a level percentage of pay or a level dollar amount. A level dollar amount is your mortgage. You know, payment, if you have just a base 30-year mortgage, same payment every month, you know it's going to be. That's a level dollar amortization. Low percentage of pay, okay, so you've got that mortgage, instead of paying $3,000 a month every month, you may start at, I don't know, $2,200, but it goes up 2.5% each pay period. So over time, you're starting off less, usually for a 30-year low percent, level dollar. The crossover is somewhere around 14, 15 years, might be a little bit later. But most plans, most cities, states, they prefer low percentage of pay because you're paying less up front. You know, you are paying less in the beginning. Over the 30-year period, you're going to pay more than if you did level dollar amortization, because that interest really adds up over time. That's 2.5% increases, or whatever your assumption is, that adds up over time. So with level, see where they have this chart on the right, the UAL amortization payments, that dark green, the biggest column, is their base layer. That's what they're talking about, their 30-year, $2.5 billion base. And these payments are increasing. You see it steadily going up. They're increasing at 2.5% per year. That's why they're going up like that. If they did a little dollar amortization, that first column would be higher, but it'd be the same all the way across. So for budgeting purposes, I guess, do you want the lower cost up front, or do you want to have a better idea what your fixed cost is going to be over time? Because if you took your $3 billion, you said, okay, we're going to amortize this over 30-year level dollar, that's going to be the bulk of the payment every year. The normal cost will fluctuate a little bit. It's going to be around that 6%. But, I mean, this is where the money is the unfunded liability. So they could budget that as a dollar amount, or at least they would know what to expect as a dollar amount every year. And then it has small differences. You'd have experience gains or losses coming in each year. Assumption changes, any plan changes, those can fluctuate, go up and down. But most plans do a low percentage of pay. Some places, so like Tennessee, state of Tennessee has mandated their plans to be level dollar.
To be what?
Level dollar. They've changed over time. I have plans in but most of my plans are low percentage of pay. There are some that are level dollar. They just wanted to not push the Tennessee, get to a point, which really came about when Memphis was in such bad shape, this is a while now, where they put in a law for all their local municipality plans, and I think Tennessee Consolidated is doing the same thing, but so they're not allowing a little percentage of pay, and they put in other requirements, which I think were a good idea, but most plans are a little percentage of pay because it's cheaper now.
But I think that what we're seeing is kind of a sampler platter of what we're going to have to dive into in a real significant, actionable way next year. You know, to Kelly's point, personally, the way I feel is that there's the first principles on this are, first of all, we need a credible plan. But secondly, we have to move the perception curve with people. The people that are currently serving in fire and police, whatever we agree to, has to feel like this creates their more certainty with their pension. And then with prospective new people, they have to come to the belief this creates more certainty with their pension. And if we fail to achieve that, but come up with something that actuarial was credible to me, I think we've failed in our job. So, you know, I think, like I said, I think it's going to be a very, very consequential year, and I don't see how we can agree on something that doesn't change people's perception, which to me is an important part of the viability of all this going forward.
I think it's really important to also speak plainly in that $3.4 billion, to your point, as an actionable plan, is upon us to tell the city what we need now and how we think the balance should be.
Well,
Is it not? I mean,
no,
like,
I mean, I think the answer is yes and no, in that it is to all of our benefits to come up with a consensual agreement where people have different interests and different priorities. And to me, that's a process that has, you know, some conflict or potential conflict to it. And any sort of dynamic process has conflict. It's how you resolve conflict that is the real difference maker. But I think that today, and for this time period now, it's education and coming up with the roadmap and understanding the core variables, which I think we're making a lot of progress on today, before we start to try to say, is this not that, or more of this, or less of that. But you're correct, and that is where we're headed.
That we were just given extremes in the proposals, but there's going to be some kind of hybrid in our actionable plan to present to the city.
Well, I'm saying we can approve something, but the city has to fund it, and not, you know, being too much of a lawyer or a legislator, which I've done neither, I think it's to everyone's interest to agree on something, but that is usually a process with conflict in it to get to an agreement, and that's likely the path here, and we want to get to the best option that, like I said, in my mind is credible, but also changes the perception gap with existing and prospective. I think we have to accomplish that as well.
So I'm trying to do this on the fly. Yeah, I got my handy dandy HP 12C here. So if I assume or my calculator, if your unfunded liability started a 30-year amortization with this valuation of the current unfunded liability, to the level dollar 6.5%. The amortization payment for 30 years would be just under $230 million each year, but you'd know what that is. The low percent of pay with the 6.5% and the 2.5% payroll growth, your first payment instead of $230 would be a little under $176 million.
Yeah.
But, and I just did, in 11 years, the payment would be greater than the $230, and by the time that 30th payment is made, that 30th payment would be $360 million. So there's a crossover point, and this calculation was 11 years. I think I said 15 or whatever, but it was 11 years. So level dollar is $230 million, boom, every year for 30 years. It pays that initial unfunded liability base. You know, there'll be experience gains and losses come in. You'd have to take those accounts, but that pays off that unfunded, whereas, like I said, low percentage of pay, it starts at 176. It goes up 2.5% every year until the total is $360 million in the last payment. And in total, you're going to pay less with level dollar amortization. Although I'm not trying to say it's good or bad. It depends. You know, budgeting is always the key. It's how you're going to pay for it. And, okay, up front, it's $5 million less, level percentage of pay. True. But, you know, that's going to increase every year 2.5%, and, you know, come 11 years, you're going to say, man, I wish we had done the level dollar, because now it's, but administrations change, priorities change, you know, budgets change, and, you know, I understand why plans use low percentage of pay. And it is a pay-based plan, so it makes some sense, but I'm just saying that, well, I'm not saying that's just what the numbers are.
So we'll have Jeff back when we get the next Chiron report and get his opinion as our actuary, since, you know, Chiron's independent on what he would recommend to the board on if we like it, if we don't, how we want to tweak it, that type of thing. But I appreciate you taking the time to talk about a little bit extra with us today.
Oh, sure.
So unless there's any more questions, I do need a motion to adopt the evaluation, which I have on the screen here, if someone would like to make that.
Would like a motion to.
I'll make.
Tony making.
Tony made it. Second.
Yeah.
All in favor.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
All right. Brenda, contract for financial auditing services.
Thank you, Nick. BDO has been the auditor for DCSC since 2014. The board has a policy to conduct a competitive selection process for certain services every 5 years, unless the board explicitly waives that requirement. In 2019, the board did waive the competitive selection process for the 2019 audit. The following year, DCSC conducted an RFP process for the auditing services for 5 years, 2020 through 2024. At that time, staff and the audit committee recommended retaining BDO as the audit service provider for the years 2020, 2021, and 2022, and the board approved this recommendation. Thank you, Jeff. Staff believes that it is important to have consistency in auditing services due to the complex material private equity legacy assets that we have not yet monetized. BDO's knowledge and experience with our current valuation processes for these assets is meaningful to our audit process. BDO has proposed a contract renewal through 2025 with fee increases limited to increases in the consumer price index, which is estimated to be around 4% in the DFW area. The staff is recommending that we authorize the executive director to renew our contract with BDO and to waive the competitive selection process for the 2025 audit. Are there any questions? Yes.
I'm going to approve it, but I have just a fundamental issue as a board member that I've vocalized before in terms of a competitive bid process. I don't like extending contracts without a competitive process. It prevents you from seeing what's out there. But I also understand that we're in a very unique situation, particularly with the recommendations and working with the city of Dallas and possible legislation. But I just want to put on note that I, in general, will not approve extensions of contracts without competitive process.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any other questions or comments?
Okay. Would someone like to make a motion to authorize the executive director to renew the contract with the BDO and waive the requirement to conduct a competitive selection process through the 2025 audit year? So moved. Second?
Second.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. I'll just say that that's well said. I think it's really hard to get another accounting firm. I mean, these people, it's like the actuaries, they have more business than they're turning down business left and right, my sense and understanding of it. So, but I do.
I mean, I agree with the concept, but
yeah,
I think
yeah.
in this situation it's particularly
yeah.
unique that it,
yeah.
it
Okay, Brenda, financial audit status.
Just to update you, the staff is continuing to work on the audited financials and our act for our annual comprehensive financial report. and we will be presenting them to the board in the first quarter of 2020.
I want to say one thing just so it's clear. When we did all the actuarial stuff, it said 2023. That was January 1st, 2023, whereas everything that Brenda and then Leo and Ryan are going to talk about, like 23, means this year that we're – so there's just a little bit of a mislabeling – not mislabeling, but you just need to understand that when they said 2023, that really is end of 22. It's just something that I had to catch myself a couple of times. Okay, and I think we got the HUF number, is that right, or we did? So that was the big, so we have everything we need, or?
Well, we did receive the HUF number. We're doing some additional procedures.
Yeah.
We're trying to get those procedures finalized.
But there's no third-party mark or anything you're still waiting on. It's all in-house, right?
Some we're waiting on the valuation on the supplemental fund. We don't have that yet.
Okay. All right.
And did that move thing the needle much?
On HUF? Uh-huh. There were significant changes there.
Okay. Where's Tad? Oh, there you are. Okay. yeah, she sits there. I'm sorry. report on professional service provider meeting.
Yeah, on December 5th, we met with Chuck Campbell of Jackson Walker. And just like I've been with all our meetings, the professional services committee, they're very satisfied with that. He's very satisfied. He hasn't worked a lot with staff this year. High marks for the staff. Pretty much been unanimous every meeting we've had. Everybody's really highly worth staff and their professionalism and how they push them. And so it was a good meeting, and we gave the staff high marks.
Great. Any comments or questions? Okay, Kelly, the approved pension ministerial actions. Talk about that in the monthly contribution report.
Sure. So on page 110 is the data around the items that you used to see on the consent agenda. So in December, we did 21 refunds, 9 estate payments, 6 survivor benefits, 12 retirements, and 1 divorce, so set up an alternate payee. And then I have the year-to-date totals. So just as a reminder, the board a couple months ago changed the policy to allow the executive director to approve these ministerial actions. Basically, I'm just following the plan and then report to you. I may change this report going forward with some more comparison information, but that's what we did in December, just for your information. Are there any questions on that? No? The next item is the contribution report. This is the same report you've seen. This is December's report with October data. Fire did an incredible amount of hiring, and we had one of the biggest rookie classes we've ever had. I think there was over 80 people in that class. So they're under the hiring plan number, I think it's on this page. Back a page. By only 14 employees, which I've never seen it that low. We've had a lot of people leave since then, but this is the closest they've been to that number, which is good news. Everything is as you would expect. No surprises, really, with the contributions. Any questions on the contribution report? Okay. The next item actually is an item sometimes we don't have a motion for because there aren't any trustees that have requested training. But as I mentioned, that TechSpurs in 2024 in April will be here in Dallas. So Nancy and TAG have requested to attend that training. And you'll see here that we have both Nancy and TAG listed on the first two items, the basic trustee training and the advanced trustee training. What I'd like to do is have the board approve all of this, and then we'll get with TAG and Nancy to determine which of these classes you want to go to, because both the basic and the advanced are at the same time on the same day.
Oh, wow.
So you can't go to both. But you're welcome to go to either one. And They're both good classes. The basic trustee training meets your first 7 hours that you're required by the PRB, but it's very good information. The advanced,
you do online anyway,
meter,
right?
You can do that. Yeah, you can do that online, but it's a different class. So if you want a refresher to hear the actuarial stuff another way, it's actually a good idea. So Carol will get with you to figure out what you want to do if the board will make a motion to approve you attending these. The conference is actually on the next day. So you could go to the basic or the advanced and go to the conference. And the conference is good. It's
okay.
Worth your time.
What's the advanced? I mean, what materials are advanced? Just a refresher or different things?
It is different information. Let me see.
And this satisfies the requirement, correct?
The advanced will satisfy your continuing ed, but it won't satisfy the first 7 hours because the 7 hours are very specific. You need 45 minutes of actuarial and this amount. It looks like, so on the advanced trustee training, the agenda has understanding investment risk and a break, and I don't have the next page. We'll send that out to you on the advanced. But anybody that thinks you might want to do it, feel free to.
Would it be helpful?
Would
it be helpful or yes?
I think so. And it's that, and the advanced actually satisfies your requirements.
Okay. Can we have a motion to approve the requested trustee training in MAPS?
Make a motion.
Second. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Ryan, portfolio
right.
Update.
All right. Go through the portfolio update. We got Makita here today to review the public equity portfolio and then do the Q3 performance report after we get through the portfolio update. So top focus still remains liquidation of the private market assets. We're at $68 million year to date. Most of that's coming from the AW property in Phoenix and the JP Morgan Maritime Fund, where we just got the final distribution a month and a half ago. Just a reminder, we rebalanced in October to refill the safe reserve up to the full 9% target, which is the 18 months of benefit outflows. Year to date through November, the total portfolio is up 8%. The 69% that's public markets is up 11.7%. And it's up another 4 or 5% to date in December, on the at least public equity is. Looking at our initiatives for the rest of this year and into early 2024, we're actually funding the new mandate with WCM today. We got the contract done about 2 weeks ago. Looking forward to Q1, we're going to kick off a custodian search shortly after the beginning of the year. That is a long process, especially if we make a change in terms of transition. So, focus on that, and then on the asset allocation, we're at 3 years, which is per our IPS, we updated, reviewed every 3 years. So starting at the January ISD meeting, we'll kick that off and talk about some initial ideas and timeline on asset allocation. I guess with the exuberance in the market the last couple weeks, this is looking at the drawdown from the beginning of 2022. So I think it's important to remember that we still are in a drawdown from market levels almost 2 years ago now, more so in international and EM than the U.S. I think the S&P might be getting close back to all-time high in the next couple of days, maybe today. But we're invested globally, and we have the EM allocation as well, so just a reminder that those are still in a pretty significant drawdown from 2022 levels. Few market charts you guys have seen before. Looking at the public markets portfolio, mentioned we were up 11.7 year to date, 13.7 in equity. If you look at the 1 month column, which we don't like to focus on too often, but markets were up quite a bit. You see a lot of red on that page for the equity managers. We have a quality bias in our portfolio, so this is expected that they would lag in a growth driven rally like we've seen in the last month.
ended the month at $1.909 billion in assets, up 8%, 109 in benefit outflows, and 190 million coming in through gain and income. Benefit outflows have covered 103% of the net benefit or private asset inflows from the private market portfolio. That covered 103% of the net benefit outflows at $10 million a month over the last 5 years. We mentioned before that situation will flip a little bit once we start making new commitments into private markets. Even though we restored the safety reserve back up to fully back at the target, we wanted to leave this chart in here just to track it with the $9.5 million a month leave in for benefit and operational expenses. We are covered through June of 2025 in that allocation. And just looking at the asset allocation, actual target, you can see on the fixed income, 4% targets down there in the middle of the chart that we drew down a little bit from each one of those areas to refill the short-term core bonds and cash back up to target. Any questions there before we get into the equity review with Makita? Okay. What do you got?
Thank you.
Yes.
Good morning.
Morning.
We have a few moments today. We'll look at your global equity portfolio. We'll just look at this meeting at the core mandate, essentially, the global large cap mandates. And at the future meeting, we will look at the completion strategies, for example, your small cap strategies and your emerging market management. So this presentation is as of the end of September. I would say the market value has not changed meaningfully as there were some drawdowns and some redemptions, but also some increase in market value from the market in November. So if you think about it, 49% percentage of the total fund, so it's a sizable piece, and it's pretty much split 50-50 between passive and active. So you may recall the ACWI index fund is set at 25% of the total fund, and then you have four managers at 6% weight each, so 6 times 4, 24. So 25-24, pretty close to that 50-50. But we're underweight, as you can see, and as you've seen from the chart that Ryan mentioned earlier, about 8 percentage points. And all of that is underweight versus the passive side. We're pretty much on par with the active strategies. And of course, one is still not fully funded. It will be later today. The rest has not changed for a number of years. The benchmark is the ACWI IMI, which is a broad investable alternative, and is the one you have on your index fund. This is a schematic of what I just described. And to put things into perspective, if you were to add the completion strategies, emerging and small caps, then we arrive at 60% in liquid equity, public equity. So to put that in perspective, for public funds and investors that have over $1 billion in assets, we look at numbers and, you know, it's you're on the higher side in terms of holding assets here versus other areas. So about 45-46% seems to be average today. Not that you have to be there, but I'm saying that so that you have a sense as to where your peers are. So if you ever look at relative performance, well, if you were funded at your target, you would be expected to do well in a month like November versus many of your peers because you have a much higher equity allocation. You are at about a top decile versus peers on your targets, a bit less because they are underweight in reality. What gives is alternatives. Many of the peers have higher weights in alternatives, including private equity, private credit, real estate, and other real assets. Your targets are lower than peers, but your actuals are somewhat closer. And then fixed income is close. 22% is about average or median, and you're not too far from it. The actual within fixed income can vary. So it includes high yield and bank loans, as well as it could include treasuries. So obviously those would perform differently in a variety of market conditions. But it all gets kind of lumped together. So more or less on track in that sense. So next year, as we do our asset allocation study, you know, sometimes clients want to know, okay, where are my peers at, just for consideration as well. So that's a perspective of where the public fund sector is today. Going into more detail with your allocations, you'll see the assets, the four satellite positions, including the up-and-coming WCM, will all have about $110 million each, which today represents roughly 6% of assets, and that is the target. And you have two value strategies, two growth strategies, and I would say one is a deeper value, one more relative value, and within the growth, again, you expect to have one that is more relative growth and one that is more aggressive growth. We should highlight a little bit what happened during the year. You'll see under technology a very large bar, if you will, on green. That's just for the year. So the technology sector gained about 60% through November. And if you were to just cut the largest of the sector together with consumer and communication, well, in that area, you had some of the stronger gains. There was a time in the year in which the performance of just seven stocks, which now are known as the Fantastic Seven, accounted for 100% of the gains in the U.S. market. And even though I'm talking about the U.S. market, and this is supposed to be global, you should know that the U.S. has been leading global equity markets. If you look at the top 10 holdings in our benchmark, the ACWI, which is, you know, the global benchmark, the 10 largest are essentially the same 10 largest that you have on the Russell 3000 or the S&P 500. They're all U.S.-based companies.
Tom, you had a question last month about the Magnificent Seven and what we have exposure-wise there. We're at 10.6% exposure to public equity to those seven stocks. The ACWI IMI is at 15, so we're underweight all of them, and collectively we're underweight about 5% compared to the index.
And that helped in 2022 and hurt on relative terms in 2023. If you look at the top 25%, top 25 holdings, only three are outside of the U.S. and 22 are U.S.-based names. So some of those completion portfolios do add diversification because it would hold us. The managers have the discretion to choose their holdings, of course, and some have very pronounced positions against U.S. larger tech-oriented names. I think the biggest example in your portfolio would be Boston Partners. We'll look at their holdings in a moment. But this is, you know, something worth you know, knowing about your portfolio versus your benchmark, because that explains that performance. This is again as of September 30th, and you know, I think a good summary is that it's working. Your five strategies, four active, one passive, over, you know, over a decade, has performed quite well. You'll see a lot of green. And in most cases, spotting at around the 30th percentile. For the year to date, up about 40 basis points through September. Now, some of that has been given in the month of November. But if you look at the 1 year, up performing by about 3 percentage points. And then for 3, 5, and 10 years, those numbers are annualized. So if you see about a percent, it's a percent per year on average. And when you add, you know, over the hundreds of millions of dollars that this portfolio has held over the years, it's resulted in minimum value appreciation for the fund.
And I'm about to talk about the fees. So all these numbers are net of all the management fees for each of the managers. And then if you look at our total public equity, I would say the performance of the four global equity managers has been really good compared to the benchmark.
the inclusion of the small cap and EM has brought down the numbers for the total public equity portfolio a little bit, just based on where we were allocated. But the four manager structure here is accomplishing what we want.
Right. And it's not an issue necessarily of poor execution for those three completion strategies. It's been an area that does not own these 7 or 10 largest names that have performed the best, and so you should expect lower numbers.
And again, this is just through September.
This is through September. Mm-hmm. On the second chart, you'll see some of the risk metrics. So these returns have been achieved with similar risk figures, if you will, so similar standard deviation to the benchmarks, similar beta. The downside capture is basically on par, and you know, the good news is that when the market has gone up historically, although not in November, there's been some additional gains in those times. With that, I will pause. If you have questions, we can go over each of the holdings. You know, we have three active strategies and the passive, and we can, you know, make some remarks there, but I'll pause because I know we're behind, and let me know if this is something you would like me to go in or is too detailed.
Is there anything by any of our managers that you want to flag, particularly good or bad, newsworthy, current, differences, anything like that?
I would say there's no surprises. So they are acting as we would expect them to act, with Boston Partners via the more value-focused strategy. And you'll see that reflected in, you know, the price to book, price to sale, the yield on the portfolio, the underweight to technology. Recall that all of these strategies are benchmarked to a core index as opposed to a value or growth index. And so as you move from Boston Partners to Manulife to Walter Scott, you see higher growth metrics in each of those portfolios. And if you had that ECM, you'll probably see the greatest with them. So no, I would say that there's no surprise. All of these are fairly, you know, or reasonably concentrated. The one that is least is Boston Partners at about 100 names. But, and I would also highlight Boston Partners is the one that has the highest presence outside of the U.S. And by that metric, it provides the most diversification, which, you know, may help or hurt depending on the precise moment in which you're measuring. But no surprise.
And then when you heard us talking about the funding and the liability, is there anything that popped in your head just as a practitioner that comes into either of you, anything that kind of popped in your head that, you know, you'd want to flag for us or say or ponder?
I would say some of the issues and pressures that these system faces are not unique. There's similar pressures by other plan sponsors and other pension funds out there. I would say the comment that Kelly made that, you know, from, you know, the plan sponsor or whoever is contributing, you know, almost always would prefer to delay those payments because it helps with budgetary and other uses of their capital. But from the perspective of a group managing the pension fund, you want to receive that money as soon as possible. So you have different tensions there. Ultimately, investments will drive a portion of the outcome, but the managing the money coming in and the money going out is very important. And, you know, you plan for a multi-decade period. The ADIC that actuaries compute is ultimately a very important figure, and to the extent that systematically the money coming in falls behind that ADIC, then that deficit has to be you know, address in future years, and if you go through that for a multi-decade period, then it becomes very difficult to get out. There's been plenty of examples of funds that pretty much went insolvent or almost insolvent as a result of that, and if you can think of, you know, Puerto Rico, Virgin Islands would be some of those examples.
The analogy I always use is the three-legged stool. You got money that comes in from investments, money from the sponsor, the city, and money from participants. Any one of the three is not functioning as it's supposed to, it doesn't really work. And, you know, the investment side is what often media picks up on, and in reality, a lot of times it's that, and what's happened here is that funding year after year compounds and gets, you know, to a giant number. I think you guys are doing the right thing, focusing on that and making sure that that part can get fixed. it's done a ton of work the last 5 years on the investment side with the new board. But it takes some time, as you were making a point, Nick. The history, the skeletons, the, you know, like the anchor around your foot, it takes a lot of years for that to kind of trail off.
Going back to the portfolio, in your review of the different managers that we're working with, have you picked up, and the fact that the market, the U.S. market is so narrow as far as performance, you know, the Magnificent Seven or Magnificent Eight, whatever you want to call it, are you comfortable with the integrity of the process of our managers as well as you're not seeing any style drift?
No, nothing that would stick at us outside of expected ranges, I would say. It's within expectations.
A good example is this one right here on the page, Boston Partners. For a long time, they were criticized for being underweight U.S. They're most valuation sensitive, and the U.S. has been the most expensive. And we'll show you in a few pages, but they still are underweight U.S. So they're not kind of throwing in the towel and giving up. They're sticking true to their beliefs that eventually, you know, markets will rotate.
Okay. Yeah, they always do that at the wrong time.
Yeah. Chasing performance never gets you anywhere.
Okay.
You can see here, for example, continuing, I picked this because if you see the top left chart, a meaningful underweight through the pandemic, and then for a brief amount of time, value came into favor, and with their positioning, they recoup all of those losses so that by the end of 2022, they had a small gain. So over less than 3 years, they made up, you know, meaningful cumulative losses versus the benchmark. And in the past 9-10 months, again, they kind of lacked a little bit. So they're performing as we would have expected, and they're just one component of the total portfolio, which on the whole, it's accomplishing what we want, which is to generate some excess return without taking undue risk.
Question.
Yes.
As we approach asset allocation review in January, is there anything we should be keeping in mind? And have you seen any discussion that changes with other funds? Like, I mean, there's been a lot of discussion, again, with alternatives. What should we be keeping in mind when we discuss asset allocation next month?
Well, few points. So we will start with the IAC in January, but it's going to be a multi-stage enterprise, meaning it's not going to be a one meeting and you can get it, and, you know, probably we'll be back a few times addressing it with the committee and then the board. And I don't think there's just one item, there's a number of them. So you have to look at your financial health. We discuss, you know, money's coming in, money's going out, liquidity profile. Some we control, some we don't. So the timing of the distributions and the actual amount of distributions from some of your legacy private holdings will have some impact. The level of interest rates will be another one. And ultimately, then the rest will be how you feel about what's best for DPFP at this time. This is the time to take on more risk, to maintain that, to reduce it. You know, and some of that will be impacted by these other variables. So couldn't think of just one or two that would rise to the top. You know, fortunately, there's going to be a lot of factors, and there's going to be has to be some give and take, and ultimately to arrive at a decision. Sometimes there is one or two that would drive it. In this case, I think there's a multitude of them.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Let's keep on.
There's one more thing. Sorry, I forgot. The good news is, the assumed rate of return is 6.5%. With the level of interest rates now, cash in our short-term treasuries are yielding today probably 5.3, 5.4. 10-year has come down, but it's still yielding 4. So on a forward-looking basis, it looks much more likely to meet that 6.5% versus, you know, 10 years ago or 15 years ago, we had to make 8.5% on a 0 to 2% type of, you know, interest rate environment. So that provides more options for us as opposed to having to really reach out for you.
Good. Thanks.
And we have Ryan.
All right.
mobile equity portfolio, I wanted to spend a minute to talk about fees and how they're structured within the equity portfolio. So this is the last month. I'll talk about 2022, December 23. But looking at the year, we had about $9.7 million in management fees, 54.54% or 54 basis points of the total assets. We focused in on the public equity managers. The average there was 48 basis points across the entire portfolio. Across the managers, we have flat fees that range from 47 to 85 basis points of asset value. The passive component that we have with Northern Trust and Acquia IMI is 3.5 basis points. We talked to Makita, did some surveys on standard public equity fees, stated fees, median fees in each of these asset classes. And eVestment has a stated fee. We did some additional research, and, you know, the stated fee is not often what people are paying, or often is not what people are paying. So we reduced 5 bits from that, and you can see in that chart that we are paying below median fees pretty significantly in all three of the four asset classes. International small cap were closer to a little bit higher than median, but we knew that going in with the managers that we hired a year and a half ago. We have two managers that are on a performance fee structure in the equity portfolio, so there's fees there can range from 0 to 1.1% based on net outperformance against the benchmark. So we started earlier this summer initiative in the equity portfolio to renegotiate fees across all of our active managers. We received fee concessions from 5 out of 8 of them. Those are going to save about $145,000 per year, lower the overall fee burden by 1.3 bits in the portfolio. Once we get equity up to the full 60% target, we'll have more passive as we're at target with most of the active managers. So expected fee burden at full allocation would be 38 bits of asset value. So any questions on fee structures and what we're looking at there?
I just like to congratulate the staff for negotiating.
Hey, Ryan, for those that for the three that pushed back, what did they say?
Two were new. And when the EM, we paid pretty competitive fees. I think this is kind of a process that I think we should go through every couple of years. So we'll, you know, next time we look at the fees, we'll understand where we got concessions and why and where the levers that we can push further are. Even though we didn't get concessions from all of them, I feel pretty good about the fee burden that we're paying in the portfolio. And we negotiate pretty hard on making sure we're paying competitive fees.
Got it. Thank you.
We're going to look at it. It'll be a little bit tougher in fixed income because the fees are already start a little bit lower, but we're going to do the same process in the public fixed income portfolio this year. Any other questions there? All right. On to performance.
All right. A lot's already been said about the investment portfolio, so I'm going to try to focus on just a few key slides and try to kind of weave the theme throughout this section of kind of the progress the board has made the last 5 years, the items that you've certainly had control over and the others that you inherited. So if you see here, this is our one-year flash summary. And my first takeaway is you see a lot more green than red, and there was a time when this was almost all red. So things are starting to work. You also look at that third line, performance versus peers. And, you know, it's nice to be green, and you're marginally above the median, 10.3 versus 10.0 over that 1 year. But the bigger observation I have, having seen this page for years, is the percentile. For the first time in a very long time, you were not 99 or 1. So your portfolio has always been so different that what you did didn't matter. It was what the market did. When the markets were up, you didn't participate. When markets were down, you didn't participate, and you would be looking great. So you're now starting to perform like a healthy pension plan in terms of the investments kind of ebbing and flowing with the markets. And the effect of the decisions and the managers are hopefully what gets you, you know, from kind of being in the 60s or 70s to the 40s and 30s and 20th percentile.
We have a celebration plan for 2105 on this. So.
I was waiting for someone to say earlier there's no chance anyone's alive then, but yeah. Hopefully at that point you're going to see all greens.
Yeah. I'll bring cupcakes.
The kind of in the middle, your public markets versus 60-40. Now, you know, some noise here because you're not invested exactly 60 equity, 40 bonds, but great results there. Over this year, that portion of your portfolio was almost 18%, and 60-40 was 13%. Okay, so here's another simple green-red. Again, you look at this, I see a lot more green than red. Another thing is you look at that five-year column, there's a lot of NAs. So that shows me that the board has made significant changes over the past 5 years because half of your portfolio hasn't even been in place for 5 years. And so these are all the public market strategies, basically the ones that you have control over firing and hiring.
Yeah, I mean, when you add WCM to that chart, more than half would be relatively new. So I think that's a consideration when we go into asset allocation where we just have built out new managers. So, you know, be cognizant of that structure going forward and what changes we want to make.
Yeah, and then if you, you know, look at the ones that have been here more than 5 years, everything's green except for one, Boston Partners. But Boston Partners plays a specific role. They're your deepest value manager, and we wouldn't want to see them outperforming against a broad benchmark at the same time your growth manager did, because then you have potential for style drift. We'd like to see them all, but we recognize why, you know, they might be underperforming over that period. So again, good progress on what you can control and a lot of decisions and actions that have been made over the past 5 years. This page here shows the regional exposure of all the managers, of all the equity managers, and there's been discussion in the past about where we're overweight and underweight in terms of which regions. If you look at the two gray rows there, that sums it all up. So on the U.S. side, you still have a bit of an underweight, 52% versus 61%. And that's because the managers in general have had a bit of an overweight to developed non-U.S. And your EM, we spent time getting that down. There was a point in time when that was going to be a really large overweight. So it's been fortunate bringing that down closer to market because that hasn't been a good place to be the last 5 years. So this is the 1 year... It's an attribution chart. And so here, there's a black vertical line there. So if you were, if all the orange dots were exactly on the line, that means DPFP would have earned that policy benchmark return down there of 14.7. So this shows you the places where elements have either outperformed or underperformed. So anything to the left is a negative, anything to the right is a positive. Green is the effect of the manager performance. Blue is the over or underweight versus target. And so, again, having looked at this chart many times, I think I point out, in the middle, all those bonds, asset classes, short-term, investment-grade bank loans, high yield, pretty much have a negligible effect. And I never see much deviation there. You can see everything is pretty much right on the line. some of that is because you have had those at target consistently the last few years. Always, it's the tail wagging the dog. You see, the biggest bars are always private equity, real estate, natural resources, infrastructure. The ones where you have less control over your sizing, so that's the blue, and the green is the kind of idiosyncratic nature of having committed many, many years ago to kind of concentrated non-market exposure private equity and non-market exposure real estate. So there's been years when you get one or two marks out of one of these strategies and you swing wildly to the right, and other years to the left. But, you know, the kind of anchor still comes into play. You know, at the end of the day, it's a year where you earn, this 12 months, you earn 10%. So good that you're participating in the markets, but still have some of this effect of the illiquid assets kind of impacting returns.
And Aaron, one more thing out. That another real conscious decision we've made as a board is to fight this out. We could have sold all this stuff at, you know, maybe something slightly higher than zero over the years, created a very, very clean go-forward track record, and pat ourselves on the back. But instead of having, you know, $1.9 or $2 billion, we would have something probably 100, 200 less than that. So, you know, staff, Ryan, they made a decision to just grind on all these, and which we all agree in terms of doing what's right for the pension is the right path. But one of the effects of that is that the track record from this chart right here, if we had, you know, written all this stuff off and sold it at distressed prices a couple years ago, we would have a weighted actual return most likely significantly higher, you know, maybe even higher than the 14.7. So it affects kind of the scorecard, but we think that's the right thing to do. So just, you know, once again, everything is great for you guys to flag. We appreciate all these comments, but it's important to see what are the effects of decisions and non-decisions. And here, I think, is a real clear one where, you know, we all know who these things are, but we're continuing to grind to try to eke out the most amount of money possible, these things. But it does make the track record look poor relative to what it otherwise would be.
Yeah. But to your point, the positive is that chart Ryan showed earlier, how many benefits have been paid by grinding out value out of those assets when you could have wiped them off your books, and that's real dollars that are gone.
Correct.
I'll end with the visual that shows that progress. This is 5 years. If you go back further, the orange and the pink just would have even been higher. So real assets are in orange, pink is private equity, green is fixed income, and blue is public equity. So you see a real conscious effort by the board over the last 5+ years to reduce those privates and reallocate to the stock market. The equity markets have been the most rewarded place to be generally over the last 5 years, so it's been fortunate that you've been able to add dollars there so those markets have been going up. Any questions?
So I'll go quickly in the private markets, just highlight the summary since we're about 15 minutes behind.
Not if you're doing.
No, but that's okay. We are
bogged down in actuarial stuff.
Which was very, very insightful. So I will just highlight these first couple of pages in the private markets report. So keep in mind there's always a quarter lag, so we have report here through the end of June. And this is the summary page. So of the investments that are still on your portfolio, not of all that you made and some of which you exited, but the ones that are still on your books, you'll see, you know, $1.3 million in commitments in aggregate, 1.3 essentially was called, so essentially all of it. So this is a very mature portfolio, about $900 million that have come back, and about $500 million or so that remains in value. And you see the delta or the change from the last quarter, first quarter through the second quarter, and there's been some distributions of $16 million, mostly from real estate, AEW holdings, managed holdings, and about a $26 million decrease in net asset value for a 1.8% negative adjustment to your books in the second quarter. And what we do now is break it down by asset class. And so you'll see essentially no activity in the private equity, but an adjustment of $19 million on real estate.
So the updated HOP number didn't report, correct?
Yeah.
So that's the HOP adjustment that we're seeing there on the 19 coming down.
Which impacts on 7%, and it has a material impact because of the size. At real estate, is the biggest impact there has been the distribution of $14 million. NAV was down at 9, but still that's a net positive. And then these were more muted, with essentially slight write-ups in NAVs for both infrastructure and agriculture, and then no action on timber. So out of all of the, let me go here, out of all of the essentially private markets holdings that you have today, there's a lot of concentration. So that half energy, you know, represents a sizable piece. If you add to that the Lone Star, you know, that's roughly 10% of book value or NAV that you have today just in two GPs. And then you have the rest is in the real estate, which I think you have more diversification. They are concentrated on the managers, but the assets are somewhat more diversified. And then the rest is the real assets piece, and those, you know, continue to perform better. Ryan mentioned earlier distributions on the J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund, and then the rest is the agriculture fund managed by Hancock / Manulife, which has performed very well for you. So with that, I will conclude. If you have any questions, I mean, now, otherwise, the rest, you know, there's been no changes to your manager. They're not calling you capital, and it's all waiting.
Can we go to your page 26, John, page 216, 217? Okay. This is what I call time theft. Absolute egregious time theft. If you look at the second to the far right, TVPI, that's ultimately the total value produced for the dollar invested. If you look at the real assets, it's .95. If you look at the next slide, private equity, it's 1.13. So combined, it's a nudge over 1.0. Okay, so that means you put in a dollar and you got X number of years later, $1, $2, something in that range. The rule of thumb, and Michael, you weigh in, is that you should be at least doing, say, 7% on something like this, maybe even 10% more, but just using 7%, every 10 years you double your money. So if we had been average, just average, in investing in this asset class, and if you look at the vintage year, and you know, that's the year you commit, so that's not actually how long the money's been out, because it gets called over time, but the most conservative thing here, you say, been at least 10 years on average, probably longer, probably closer to 15, that the average dollar has been called. So that would be like you put it in the stock market 10 or 15 years ago, and what would it have compounded to? So just being incredibly conservative, if you had been competent, not good, you would have doubled over time 10 to 15 years the money that you deployed. Michael, would you agree with that? So if you look at paid in capital, it's $1.25 billion for real assets, and it's $800 million. So that's $2 billion of just time theft. So we talk about our liability, and we say, where did that come from, or how did that occur? That's time theft. And that's just competence and governance and all these things, you know, bit by bit, you know, stupid decision by stupid decision every you can look at these and see, you know, a few of them are okay, but literally you could have had, you know, someone knows nothing, throw darts against a board, pick from the universe, and most likely would have done better than this. Would you agree with that, Aaron?
100%.
Yeah.
If you look at the right column, the far, both TVPI or IRR, it's like every other is negative. You know, he basically was, I don't know what, how the decision was made in the past, but swinging for the fences. Some worked out and others were total busts.
I mean, that means there were, I mean, yeah, swing for the fences would be a generous statement. So, so I mean, not to harangue people, but just saying, like, what happened, you know, as we go into decision-making mode, in my mind, this is easily $2 billion of that liability.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
You know, in the sense of visuals, which may come in handy in the future, and consistent with your remarks, on page 182 where you have the colors and the allocation, mm-hmm. it would, I think it could be helpful as we go further to get that on a 10-year basis.
Yeah, we've done plenty of these charts over the years, so we have it going back. Some of it goes in the annual report, some of it, you know, so.
Okay.
And, yeah, it's more striking when you were down to 5% in public equity in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Good point, though. Doesn't tell the story. Anything else?
All right. Thanks so much, guys. We so appreciate the role you guys play here. So thank you.
Excuse me. thank you. One thing I'd like for us to consider, particularly for 2024, I think we've been going through slides now for like 45 to 50 minutes. As a public board, we need to make sure that we understand that the public is looking at us. And I just wonder whether we are communicating as well with the public as we can. We go through in great, great detail tons of tables and charts, which all of us need to read them, but I'm not quite certain if it's best use for us to spend 45 minutes to an hour going through slides for a board meeting. I would like to ask if we can streamline that some, and also we also have an investment advisory committee that gets into all the, you know, the nuts and bolts, but I don't know if we're serving the public very well by going through all of this information. Information is necessary, and they definitely should be in backup, but I'm not quite certain if it's the best use of time for the public, particularly in 2024, to go in through to just extreme detail at a board meeting. Just a comment.
Yeah, I mean, I think that maybe make a suggestion or two specific, like you kind of did, but I would say, look to do that, and yeah, I'm all ears. Anything we can do, streamline this, and to be better communicators is the way to go.
Yeah, I can probably give some suggestions,
yeah.
But I think we probably would want to say that, again, we should be spending less time on talking about VIPs and things like that in the public, which most of the public doesn't know what a VIP is.
Yeah, I think it's a balance. It's not always easily determined, but on the one hand, we have a responsibility in messaging and educating. On the other hand, I get where we want to be efficient with our time and so forth. Yeah, there's no easy answer.
Yeah.
I think and it's going to change over time as our situation and environment changes. So I see both sides. I'll be a member of.
I'm not sure I understand it. Is it the time issue or is it the level of detail? Because for me,
yeah, I agree.
Having the detail is important, not only from informational learning, but also so the public knows the kinds of data that is generated to to make decisions. So I'm not sure I understand your...
I think there are two things. One is the time. I mean, I don't know what the typical pension fund use, spends on this. And two...
Is it the time of the trustees in attending the meeting?
Well, yeah, in terms of what the public is seeing. So, again, my point is that the detail is important for board members to make decisions. I'm not certain how much the detail in terms of many of these tables and that detail is necessary for a board meeting, particularly if we have an investment advisory committee that is charged with doing a lot of the nuts and bolts. So I think the data is important. I just think maybe how it's presented for board meetings may be kind of missing the mark in terms of what we're trying to do and the decisions we're making. That data is always available. Doesn't mean that it has to be, we need to see as much for the board meeting. Data should be available, but I don't know if it's necessary for us to spend that time on all that those pieces of data. That's my
opinion. You know, on the public messaging part of that, you know, one thing I'd like to share is Kelly, excuse me, Kelly and Nick know this, but one of my wife's good friends from where she grew up is a firefighter in Dallas. I think it's Station 36 over on the southwest side of the city. And about 6 weeks ago, he asked if I would just come over there on a Sunday night to, like, hang out, eat some food, and kind of give the guys, you know, an update, you know, as I saw it as a trustee. And it was incredibly – I found it incredibly valuable to be able to spend time and, you know, just let them kind of ask questions, you know, unfiltered about things that they're hearing or seeing or, you know, being, you know, they're reading or what have you. So maybe part of the public messaging part of that is maybe we let folks dial in more, or maybe we try to just be more proactive and maybe do more of that outreach and go see folks and touch base at different stations. That, you know, I don't know. I'm just throwing it out there to help with the public messaging part.
Yeah, I think that is a good idea. I've done a little bit of that. When I meet with Chief Garcia every year, last couple years I've offered it, and he's not said, like, yeah, let's make that happen. I mean, so I have asked, but I think maybe our police and fire, maybe we can look at that as well. But that doesn't address the point you're making. So I would just say make some specific suggestions, and if they make sense, we'll do it.
I'll just say this, because of what happened in the past.
I agree.
And because the way the police and fire view the pension because of that history, I think to err on the side of providing more information in the meetings is a prudent decision, because to make it all available to us and discuss some of this stuff a little more in depth makes it more transparent. I
would have to echo, I would be in agreement with you, because I also go to a lot of the stations as well, and at the end of the day, we are fiduciaries to members, and members are listening, and we've had this history played by transparency and bad decision-making, and they're just more comfortable with more information. And to Tom's, this balance is very difficult, because you want it to be efficient, but you want it to be informative and transparent, and some topics are a little bit arcane. So I don't know where that is, and we can do better about communicating to our audience, which is the citizens of Dallas as well as fire and police. So, you know.
No, I hear you saying. I think we do need to be transparent. I just think in 2024 we might want to see if there are ways that we can improve being transparent, because transparency also means not overloading with data.
But then we ask our constituents what they would like.
Yeah, that's just a charge. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but I, you know, as long
that's
as I've
fair.
Been on the board, that's one thing I wonder, what are other people hearing? And I kind of wonder whether we're being as fair to the public in terms of being efficient communicators. And sometimes I think we may not be. And I'm happy to provide some suggestions.
Well, I think that's a messaging issue separate from the detail of the board meeting, and that probably needs to be addressed separately.
Okay, well, I know all of you, just off the top of your head, know about Section 2.025 of Article 6243A-1, so we don't have to provide more clarity, but we're going to get an update on it now.
So that section is this big funding thing that we've been talking about, right, with Chiron and the independent actuary. And what I'm going to talk about now is not what I planned on talking about this morning. So today at 3 o'clock, there is a meeting of the City Council Pension Committee. It's 8 members of City Council. And I didn't know what the presentation was going to be because I didn't get it in advance. Checked for it this morning at 8:30. It still wasn't out there.
I checked for it again
when Makita was talking, and it's there. So now I kind of know what's out there. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But let me just give you a little background. So today at the meeting, ERF is going to present, and then the mayor's task force is going to present, and it's going to be Bill Quinn and Rob Walters and a gentleman that I haven't met named John Stevens. And as you know, I have complete and total respect for both Bill and Rob. And I've been working very closely with them in the last couple of weeks to help them get some information from Chiron. And what's been going on is we started with the November 9th presentation that you all saw and the City Council saw. And the mayor's task force, Rob, wanted additional analysis based on that. And I appreciated the fact that they wanted Chiron to do that additional analysis, because one of the big problems that we had in 2017 was the city's actuaries' numbers were just so different than our actuaries' numbers, and it just created so many problems. So when they reached out and said, can Chiron do this, I didn't really want to pull Chiron off their real big job for us and delay that, but I didn't want to have numbers that weren't consistent. So we talked to Chiron. They agreed to run the additional analysis. It's going to cost us more money because it's outside of the scope, but I thought it was worth it. So they provided a December 5th report based on what the mayor's task force asked for. And what it was basically take the November 9th report and tell us what the impact would be if you had various different lump sum amounts coming in 2028. And then also what would happen if you had plus or minus your 1% of your 6.5% rate of return. So what happens at 5.5% for 30 years? What happens at 7.5%? I thought those were good numbers. It was based on the November 9th presentation. And then I got the raw data of that information, and then I offered to provide graphs and charts to help the mayor's committee present whatever they wanted to present, because I can do that. Chiron didn't need to do that. We didn't need to pay for that. Then the group asked for another set of numbers, and what they wanted was a modified version of what Chiron presented on November 9th with those same scenarios, different lump sums, different rates. But they modified the underlying Chiron information. And we got Chiron to do that. They sent the information to me. They said, we would not support this version of the modification. And I conveyed that information to Bill and Rob, that here's the number you asked for. I think it's important that we all are on the same page with the numbers. By the way, Chiron has told me they won't support this in the final recommendation.
The support, what specifically?
The way that they have the amortization that we talked about, the way they have it tailing. Chiron, as you recall, had it tailing lowering in the last 5 years. What they asked for in the new modification is it doesn't lower in the last 4 years. So what that does is it puts $252 million of contributions 29 and 30 years out instead of over these years. But it's the mayor's task force. They can present whatever they want, right? It's their recommendation. So I then took the raw data, prepared a bunch of graphs and charts and things like that. So those are the slides that will be presented, because I'm looking at them right now in the presentation. I prepared them. The numbers are based on Chiron's numbers. It doesn't mean I recommend those, just I want you to know that for one thing. But also when I'm reading first of all, their presentation starts with 9 slides that they've already presented before about why we have the problems we have. Kind of irrelevant, but it's their presentation. And then they get into their recommendations. And reading these recommendations, this is the first time I've seen them. I 100% agree and appreciate the mayor's committee saying more money in the plan is really important, and the city big effort in that. 100% agree that's the right answer. I don't agree, and I'm not sure Kiowa would agree with much of their other recommendations. So let me, and I actually had Melissa send this all to you. Since it's a public document, I found it on the city's website. But you don't need to read it now. I'll just kind of, on page 14 and 15 are the recommendations. I don't know how they're going to explain, you know, talk to this, so I might be totally wrong. But as I read it and my understanding for doing the charts is what they want to do is put in additional money in fiscal years 25, 26, and 27 as a fixed amount, an extra $20, $40, and $60 million in those years, instead of going to the ADC right away. And you might recall that Chiron recommended going to the ADC, but it's a graded amount. So that looks like $120 million more, which is a good thing. It also, if you say glass half empty, half full, it's also if you went to the ADC and paid the full ADC, it's not paying $100 million that you would have paid if you went fully there and didn't grade it. That also isn't Chiron's recommendation. They recommended the grade up. So that's one thing. And then they're recommending going to the ADC starting fiscal year 2028. And the charts they're showing are ones that Chiron doesn't recommend. So I don't know what's going to underline the amortization under that. Assuming it's that, I'm not sure we could. I would recommend that. But I don't know. I don't know exactly what they're thinking. They also talk about a corridor, which a corridor is a concept that's used by both Houston and Austin. And it can work. But a corridor and a cap are not the same things, and I think the city is talking about a cap on their contributions. And you can't have a cap on the contributions and then guarantee you're going to be funded in 30 years because it might not be enough. So that's one of the points. And the other point is that the city, the plan submitted to the Pension Review Board should not include anything like any benefit increases such as the COLA change. I'm not sure where our board is going to come out on that. I don't know what Chiron's ultimate recommendation is going to be. They talked about that. So I just wanted to let you know, if you see news today or if you watch the city's presentation, yes, I prepared this. I totally 100% agree with more money coming in soon is great. These recommendations, in my mind, need a little bit of tweaking before I could say they would be something that I would recommend to the board.
One question, and I haven't read it, so I'm looking forward to reading the recommendations. What's the source of funds?
The source of funds, it doesn't say in here. I mean, they have something, they have some recommendations on monetizing some assets to go in for the early years. But in the city's budget, that's not our role to say where the money comes from.
Okay.
So I just say, I mean, number one, I really do appreciate the task force. They are working very closely with the city. It's the board's responsibility, according to the statute, to consider what the independent actuary says when you make your final recommendations or final rules or final adjustments to the plan. You know, I'm sure you're going to consider what the city wants as well, and this probably will be something like the city wants. There's just a lot of details underneath this that we'd have to make sure we're all on the same page. Are there questions about that? Or
I think everyone should review it, and I think we should make as an agenda item for the next meeting a discussion of this and any subsequent news or whatever comes out of it. I think a lot of stuff we learned about just education, this is the application of education on some of the things here, but I don't think, I mean, unless someone can say whatever they want, but
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, we don't know.
It sounds as if, you know, that the task force is the mayor's task force, to be clear, right? It sounds as if it affects us, but is it really even in our lane right now? I mean, they can do what they want and suggest it. I'm assuming that the city will, you know, consider it in terms of how they, you know, will want to negotiate what they think is in their best interest. But for the most part, does it mean anything to us?
No, I don't think it does. The city can do what the mayor's task force can do whatever they want. The city can do whatever they want. At the end of the day, this board has the responsibility for two things only, adopt a plan, consider the independent actuary thing. We all want to get along with the city. We understand there's funding issues. We don't want to Yeah. You know, we want to help them make their budget because that's good for everybody. I would think that this board would consider, you know, very strongly what the city wants. We just also have to understand what's
And again,
under
you say do, but it means suggest. They can suggest whatever they can propose. It's not like they can do anything. It's nothing that what's coming out is actionable. It's just proposals and suggestions. At the end of the day, we have to come up with a plan that's executable.
Yeah, because the city council still has to vote, right? On whatever recommendation they adopt, whatever they want to adopt.
City council can vote on whatever they want, and they definitely have to approve their budget.
Yeah.
This board will adopt whatever plan it adopts. Those two things are separate.
So is it correct in saying that we have a responsibility by statute to adopt the plan that conforms to the 30-year limit?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And we do that, yet we don't have a enforcement mechanism that automatically compels the city to fund it, right?
That might be getting into a legal.
Yeah, we're there again.
Okay. All right.
So far the recommendation, obviously none of us have seen the document, but the recommendations, are they suffice? The influx of, I don't know what the recommendation is, but I'm assuming that there is a recommendation for the city to make some kind of influx of.
Yeah, the task force is recommending that the city put in significant amount of money and go to an ADC and try to fund things early. Those are all really good things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that.
So it isn't like, just a piece of it, it is ultimately to address the entire problem.
Well, we're going to come out with a plan that funds the liability in 30 years. We have to do that.
Right.
And we would ideally like the city to adopt, to vote, and make that their plan as well. That would be the goal, and to do that in a way that both funds the obligations and also in the environment, you know, helps compel people to stay and new people to join. I mean, that's the way I look at it, but there's definitely different thoughts on when and how much, and that's what we're going to have to work through over the course of 2024.
I guess one thing that it would be relevant, just in terms of whatever the task force has recommended, whether people ask us for, you know, ask members of this pension board or its staff to comment on this recommendation. I guess, at least for me, and I know we have a certain policy, I have no comment on it, because it really doesn't have anything to do with, you know, what our job is in terms of what we want to, what we're obligated and bound to provide.
Yeah, I think you're, especially given the really intricate nature of the actuarial concepts here, I think more than ever it's important for, at least from my perspective as the, you know, as a lawyer, to say the board, I would urge the board to follow the policy of just public statements be made by, you know, the policy requires that be done by Kelly or Nick, which is the second director and chairman. And I would think here they're going to be the most informed people of the board, and, you know, and they should be the ones and only the ones that are making public statements at this point in time.
Well, I also think it's important to the, I mean, you know, if you make, I mean, one, I have no comments on it. Two, I can't speak. And even if I did, I would not feel comfortable making any statement that has any implication for the board as a whole. So,
right. And that's the other thing, is that the board, I mean, as I think Kelly and Nick both said, I mean, the board hasn't taken a position yet. It's just, we're just still gathering information. So,
right.
Yeah.
Is the purpose of the meeting just to kind of educate them on the progress of the?
No, today's meeting is for the task force to give their recommendation to the committee.
But they're completed. These are the recommendations.
Yes.
They're done with their study, and they're going to present it today.
Yes.
Okay.
Task force being Bill and Rob.
Yeah, the mayor's task force.
The mayor's task force was supposed to submit multiple. My understanding was that they were going to give them multiple options, or this is kind of their, this is what they come up with.
They have multiple options on different ways to monetize assets. That's what's
and that's it.
Yeah.
It's not multiple.
It looks like to me it's kind of a menu.
Mm-hmm.
So the recommendations are, here's the menu. What actually,
mm-hmm.
within the menu, there's still choices to be made.
And they had a third-party actuary present and say, this is kind of the schedule we came up with, say $158 million going up all the way to $400 million, and what they came back with is we're going to pay 20, 40, 60, and then start going to 80.
Well, so the 20, 40, 60 is not that far. I mean, it's actually more than the initial grading up of the Chiron numbers. The initial grade up of the Chiron was 17, 34, 50, 6, 54. So it's more than the grading of the Chiron on their preliminary report. Those numbers will change. So that's not nothing. I mean, it's absolutely not nothing.
Well, and the second recommendation here is to monetize, to start the process of monetizing the asset there. So it's not just that initial contribution or additional. It's to immediately start the process there.
And I think that's the big part of their recommendation really is you need to monetize these assets and get money into the plan early. And I did it. You'll see them in their charts that show if you have a lump sum of $500 million going in 28, or $1 billion or $1.5 billion, what does that do to your ongoing incremental contribution? It's, you know, big numbers. So,
are we competing in the same meeting with the Dallas ERS?
Competing? They're presenting.
ERS.
They're presenting. Okay.
They're representing as well.
Their presentation was also posted this morning, which I was looking at during the keynote presentation. They're presenting first, and then the mayor's committee.
But to that point, I believe that that part of this is creating as much certainty around sale assets and those funds coming in. Like, that's a big part of it. I mean, that there can be like a best effort, maybe down the road type standard versus like a public company announcing we're exploring strategic options, which means that this is for sale today. And so, to me, making it more like it's a here and now certain thing is another big, big part of this that we need to work through.
Why did you say 2028?
Why did I say 2028?
Yeah.
That's what they asked me to run.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you have anything to add?
Do you want to go into closed session now?
Before we go into closed session, I want to make an observation on one of the legal items. I don't normally talk about things in public, but because we have David Elliston here, David, I think most of you know, if not all of you know, David is the president of the Dallas Police Retired Officers Association. I want to note, I sent an email out that indicated that we had been successful in the appeal that David's organization had brought on the case involving their challenge to the COLA, the annual adjustment. The Court of Appeals upheld the district court's ruling. I'm sure David's disappointed about it, and I'm not here to gloat. First of all, I like David. David is a very upstanding guy. Hopefully most, if not all of you, read his op-ed this week in the Dallas Morning News.
Yep.
It was very good. I've called David the loyal opposition. I have no ill will for David bringing cases. I understand he's got the right to do that. His organization's got a right to do that. I would note that if the position is ultimately upheld, however it's finally the final judgment by the Supreme Court or otherwise, I think cities like the city of Dallas and other cities probably owe a debt of gratitude to David and the people, because that case and other cases have shown that cities can negatively adjust downward benefits, such as COLAs and things like that, if they have funding issues. So I think that's an important point that cities should perhaps say thank you for making the law clear, and it hasn't been clear up until before 2016. So I'm not here to thank David, but I think David
has tried his best for his organization, and again, I commend you to his op-ed if you haven't read it yet. So
take that one.
I think, you know, the ultimate result of that case and what it could mean for cities like Dallas and other cities about how they adjust pension benefits is incredibly important. So I think with that, I'd say we should go into closed session.
Okay. Let's do this. Let's do D2, which is the last open session thing before we go to supplemental, just so we knock it out of the swing closed and
okay.
Open again. So let's do that.
All right. Your association newsletters are in there starting at page 224 for you. We didn't have any open records requests since the last meeting. On page 237, we've listed next year's board meeting dates. They're all on the second Thursday of the month, but if there's conflicts that you already know about, let us know. And if there's some, a lot of people gone on a certain meeting, I can talk to Nick about maybe moving something. Staffing update. So Carol Huffman, who you all know, she is retiring. This is her last board meeting. She has been with the city and the pension for 48 years.
Wow.
So it's going to be really strange to not have Carol around. I said earlier in the meeting that she'll be contacting you on the training or something. It's actually going to be Sasha has been promoted to fill Carol's very large team. So Sasha's out there. You've met her before. But publicly, I just wanted to thank Carol for all of her years with the pension and hope she has fun.
Can she come in here? And just,
she could. Will you get her?
Can we do that drop thing where she retires but doesn't retire?
I don't think she'll do that.
Okay.
She was telling me the other day she can't get her work done before she leaves. I'm like, move your feet.
Carol, we just want to say we'll miss you. You've done a great job. You're one of those anchors. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And you've really served the city and its pension and everyone so well. So thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Let's go.
All right.
We have one employee, Trish, who's been here 10 years, so I just announced her service award. She's one of our counselors. So that's all I have for the executive director's report. So we will go into closed session for the next item. The whole item will be done in closed session.